Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
This is Jessica with Syosset Libraries Turn the Page podcast. And our guest today is
Linda Maria Frank.
And welcome back. We had such a good time talking to you about DNA the last time. That was like a really, really good conversation. But we have a completely different conversation to talk about today. And today we are going to, I guess kind of two parts, because we're first going to start talking about your book, Annie Tillery, The Mystery of the Lost Avenger, and we're going to go into female spies. Is that correct?
Well, the two are really very related, because when I was writing the book, I got into the whole subject of espionage during World War II, and that of course led me to the realization that women in World War II were the war could not have been won without the work that these women did. And so that led me to plan out a lecture, because I do a lecture series, and one of them is called it's about women spies, and the title of it is, and I never could remember this, not exactly James Bond, but The Women Who Spy, from the American Revolution to the Cold War. And so both of these things, both the book and the spy lecture, took a tremendous amount of research, but I could not believe how much these women did. And what that inspired me to do was to dedicate the lecture, because this is the year of the woman. I mean, this is, we've only had the vote for 100 years, and I think this is something to celebrate. So, without further ado.
Yes. so let's talk. We can go one into the other then, in that case.
We can.
Okay, so The mystery of the lost Avenger. The Avenger is not a person, correct?
Right. The Avenger is, it's really the Grumman Avenger. And the Grumman Avenger was a plane that was manufactured by Grumman Aviation in Bethpage, which now Grumman is pretty much only involved in electronic surveillance, and they don't make planes anymore. But during World War II, they were one of the major plane manufacturers. You might remember the names Hellcat, Wildcat, and then, of course, during the more recent wars, it was the Tomcat. The Tomcat was made out in Calverton, Long Island. So that's the plane, and actually, this is the plane that George H. Walker Bush, that's the plane he crashed in and was rescued from sea to become one of our presidents. But that's the plane he flew, and what the plane did was it dropped torpedoes, and it was very, very influential in the war in the Pacific. So the planes were manufactured by women at the Grumman plant, and they were tested by women, and then they were flown by women to the West Coast, where they were put on aircraft carriers. So the reason why this mystery story about this teenage sleuth revolves around this World War II airplane is because I went to the Cradle of Aviation Museum in Long Island, and it was one of those days that you could actually sit in the planes. So I was wandering around, my family was doing something else, and I came across this plaque. And the plaque talked about what I just said, that the planes were manufactured by women. So I climbed into the plane, which at my age was no mean feat, but I was sitting in the plane, and I could hardly see over the dashboard. It was very interesting to sit in that plane. And this feeling came over me, and I said, I have to write a story about these women. So I fleshed out a story, and what I did was I figured out generation-wise that this would have been my heroine, Annie Tillery, it would have been her great-grandmother who would be involved in this. So what I did was I started the plot with the fact that a plane that crashed in 1943, the wreckage was only found in 2014, and in the wreckage was a note written by her great-grandmother. Her great-grandmother, she wasn't in the plane, but a note was found in the plane, and it caused NCIS, which, of course, the plane is a Navy plane, so they would be investigating this cold case. They traced it back to Annie's family, and her father and mother show up with a letter from NCIS. And, of course, Annie is so excited because she never knew about this great-grandmother and what she did. Like many teenagers, she wasn't really paying attention to family history. So they end up researching, and they go to the family attic, which is located in a very old house in Maryland. And, of course, it's a creepy attic. And a ghost shows up, and they find in the attic lots of letters between her great-grandmother and her fiancé who flew the plane in the war. And they realize that the letters are in code, so they have to crack the code. And they find out that actually great-grandma was involved in an espionage plot, and she was influential in bringing those spies to justice.
How
and
cool!
So that's how the book. So the book is loaded with all kinds of forensic stuff because the body that's found in the plane. Of course, they have to find out who that is and why the plane crashed. And of course, when they discover why the plane crashed, then they know it was espionage, that it was sabotage, I should say. And there's the forensic aspects, and of course there's the history aspects, because some of what I put in is actually true history about espionage that was going on Long Island. Many people who were alive at the time, and those people are fast disappearing because it's so long ago, will tell you that they could see submarines surfacing off the coast of Long Island during World War II. So this was such an exciting book to research, and I realized that the most influential women in my life lived during that time. And I'm old enough that my earliest memories, and I was really a tiny child at the time, my earliest memories revolve around World War II. So this was just really a very exciting book for me to write, and also a very emotional book to write.
It sounds like it, and it sounds like there's just so much history. I mean, you know, as a Long Islander, I know myself and my husband are children or grandchildren, I'm sorry, World War II vets, and they both flew. My grandfather, I'm not sure what plane he flew in, but he was the sole survivor of a crash, and my husband's grandfather flew in an Avenger, and
Wow. They
also crashed, however, in the Pacific. However, I think everybody actually survived that one. But it's really just very interesting. And I don't really think, number one, as Long Islanders, I think a lot of our history in World War II, we forget. And the submarines, I mean, I grew up hearing about that, too. And that sounds just so claustrophobic. I mean, I know sometimes we like to think of ourselves as part of New York City, depending on where on Long Island we are, you know. But it really just the idea that everything was just so close to us is amazing.
Yeah. Long Island actually has a very, very long and interesting history going back to the Revolutionary War and probably before, simply because of our location. We were actually economically more important than New York City in a way because we produce the food out here.
Yeah.
And actually, we were the home of a very, very important spy ring that was commissioned by George Washington.
The Culper spy ring, correct?
Yeah, the Culper spy ring, which was just in Setauket, which is not too far from me, and certainly much closer to Syosset. But, you know, I always wondered why so many schools on Long Island were named Woodhull.
So,
and now I know.
So for our listeners who might not know, and then we can get into, if you don't mind, we can get into the women spies from American Revolution and beyond. So would you like to explain why the significance of that name?
Well, the significance of it was that obviously once the Revolutionary War got going, because of Long Island's location, because it was close to New York City, and of course at the time during the Revolution, New York City was under the British. I mean, the British had control of it, not the Continental Army, not the Americans. So it was very important to have spying because we had to know how many troops were coming in and what the movement of those troops were, what their supply chains were, blah, blah, blah. You know, the usual stuff with war. So George Washington commissioned a young cavalry officer named Benjamin Talmadge, and he had him form a spy ring. And the spy ring actually involved a farmer by the name of Abraham Woodhull, who was his childhood friend, and a man by the name of Caleb Brewster. And Woodhull lived in constant anxiety of being discovered, and by the summer of 1779, he had recruited another man, the well-connected New York merchant Robert Townsend. There's another name that we see an awful lot on Long Island, Townsend, to serve as a primary source in the city. So they had to have this information chain coming back and forth. And how it involved women was that, of course, places, you have to think back what it must have been like in those days. It was taverns and inns where information could be passed, where people would stop. It would be okay for a traveler to stop at an inn. It was a logical place so that they wouldn't raise suspicion. And, of course, the people who raised the least suspicion in those days were women. So Austin Rowe, a tavern keeper in Setauket, who acted as a courier for the Culper spy ring, he traveled into Manhattan with the excuse of buying supplies for his business. And a local Setauket woman and Woodhull's neighbor, a woman by the name of Anna Smith Strong, she was said to have been, she was a messenger. Her husband was a local judge by the name of Celia Strong. That's another name you hear on Long Island. And he was in a prison ship, so she was running the operation herself. And what she did was she used the laundry to give her messages. And how she did this was she would hang out either a black petticoat or a white petticoat. And the black petticoat said no messages, and the white petticoat said there's a message. And then she would hang handkerchiefs. And the number of handkerchiefs that she would hang on the line would indicate which inlet on Long Island, because you have to think about the coastline of Long Island is full of all these little canals and inlets, which have been used for various reasons over our history. But the number of handkerchiefs that she would hang out would tell where the contact would be made. So that was Anna Smith Strong. So she was one of the most important people in that spy ring because of her ability to give those messages. And evidently the British didn't figure it out, which was a good thing.
That's really clever.
What you find out about the British was that they felt that their forces were so superior to the Americans, which they were, that this was going to be a no-brainer. They were going to win this war. They were going to, you know, they were going to suppress the colonists, and everything would be great. And actually, when you think about it, the Americans fought a guerrilla war. And it is very difficult. We learned this in Vietnam, to win against an enemy who was waging a guerrilla war while the British were running around in their red coats.
Right. Yes. Yeah, it was. I remember the first time, you know, when I was much younger and we were learning just about how wars were fought back then. It was almost like it seemed to be very staged, just the combat part of it. But the behind the scenes, I mean, that was some pretty surprising stuff. And yeah, that's true. It was a guerrilla war. And I believe they weren't expecting that.
No, they didn't know how to deal with it, because that isn't the way wars were fought. I mean, you have to understand that the people in Europe have been fighting wars for hundreds of years. I mean, that's what they did. There was the 100 Years War and the 30 Years War. And I believe that the French and Indian War in Canada and the northern parts of the United States was an extension of, and I'm not sure of this, but it's either the 100 Years War or the 30 Years War. I think it was the 30 Years War. Because, you know, we don't think of this now, but the regents, the kings and the queens in Europe were always fighting one another.
Right.
They just thought, well, we have this wonderful trained army and we have our cannons and whatnot, and we're just going to win this war. And they didn't realize that they'd never come across anything like this. I mean, these were men who had no uniforms. They dressed to melt into the forest so they couldn't be seen. And they sniped at them, and they, just the way they fought, they just couldn't win. And it was a shock. Every time they lost a battle, it was a shock. But they did have a real stranglehold on the colonies as far as you know, having an embargo and the colonials not being able to get goods from Europe and not being able to send their goods back to the, you know, that triangle, to England and to the Bahamas and back to the United States. So it was economically very tough on the colonies, but we prevailed, and I'm glad we did.
So beyond the Culper spy ring, getting to the Civil War, female spies in the Civil War.
Well, I didn't find anything about them being involved in the Civil War. It was the Revolutionary War. In the Civil War, there was a whole bunch of in fact, I'll get to that. But there was another woman who was also involved in, in espionage, and her name was, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly, Lydia Darragh. I think she's Irish, so it's D-A-R-R-A-G-H, Darragh, I think it is. And again, she was a Quaker. She didn't believe in violence, but they were patriots. And so what she did was ran an institution. No, I shouldn't say an institution. What would happen is there would be meetings at their home, and there would be British soldiers and mostly soldiers, I guess, talking about what their military operations were, and she would eavesdrop. And then she would take messages, and she would secrete them in the buttons of her son's coat. And so then her son would be able to take those messages and deliver them to the Continental Army. And she was a very brave woman. One night, December 4th, 1777, she left the city with the excuse of getting flour from a mill outside of town. Once there, she met with a Patriot soldier and handed over a message about the impending attack to Colonel Elias Boudinot. This warning gave Washington's men time to prepare for the attack, which ended in a standoff. Her bravery and cunning were crucial in ensuring that the attack at White Marsh did not end in a massacre. So, and White Marsh is a name that stands out to me because I have relatives in Maryland, and there's a whole section of Maryland. In fact, when you go down Route 95, it's all White Marsh this and White Marsh that. So I'm assuming that's where it was. So she was also another spy that I came across. There's also the site of the home of Abraham Woodhull, right on Long Island. And Long Island is full of these historic signs. You'll see the blue and gold. And unfortunately, many of the buildings are gone, but the sites are still there.
I think there's like a whole trail that you can go down for the spy ring that I've seen. And that would be a really cool day trip to take with family and to teach history.
Yes, yes. And then we come to the Civil War. So the Civil War, the first person I came across was Harriet Tubman, of course, who ran the Underground Railroad. Of course, Harriet Tubman, and there's just been a movie about her called Tubman. You know, her exploits are well known, and actually there is a place in Brooklyn on Orange Street, which is a church where Harriet Beecher Stowe's brother was a preacher, and actually that was one of the terminals of the Underground Railroad. So this Brooklyn, that especially Brooklyn Heights, is full of sites that were important, because one of the most important battles of Revolutionary War was the Battle of Brooklyn Heights, which we lost. The Americans lost it, but it was still Brooklyn was right there in the middle of our Revolutionary War. And of course, segueing into the Civil War, we were also, New York was very involved in the Civil War as well, even as so far as taking Irish immigrants right off the boat and putting them into the Union Army, which caused riots in New York. But I like to get to the spies, because the women spies are really quite interesting. There were spies on both sides, and they were all these women were usually of good families, and they were in the position to overhear various information that was, you know, that they'd be entertaining military personnel in their homes, and their husbands would be talking to them. And that's how they became spies. Pauline Cushman is a very interesting example of that. She was, the way she covered her activities was, she was challenged by one of the, the Confederate, one of the Confederate generals to show her loyalty. And so she toasted the Confederate general. And because of that, she was beyond suspicion, and she continued to spy for the Union Army. There was also some African-American women who spied. Mary Elizabeth Bowser was another one. And basically what they all had in common was the fact that they were women. They were almost invisible. You have to think in terms of many of the women at the time. In fact, most of them, they were servants in their own homes. You know, if there was entertaining to be done, unless they were very wealthy and had lots of servants, they were the ones who brought in the tea, brought in the food, and they were basically invisible, and the men really didn't give them too much thought as far as they would be able to think about the war and spying and stuff like that. That made them really good spies. Mary Elizabeth Bowser was an African-American woman, and she was a servant, and she was also, what did she do now? She gave an address in Brooklyn alluding to her infiltration of the Confederate White House during the war. See, because she was a servant, she got into the Confederate White House. And so she was a source of tremendous information. One of the things that I found very interesting was, this is a name you might remember, Belle Boyd.
Yes.
That's a name that struck me as being very familiar. But the Confederate women spies, most of them were caught, and they were all incarcerated in the same prison. The prison was right outside Washington, D.C. And this is, you know, it was just so interesting to me. And I wondered if they got together and talked to each other. It would really make a very interesting movie, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, that it would. And I just wanted to kind of really quickly, because you started with Harriet Tubman. One thing that I learned about Harriet Tubman a while back, which I thought was interesting, was that she had narcolepsy.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's the Civil War.
Yeah.
And that's basically what I found. There were many women spies. What they all had in common was they were able to overhear a lot of different information, and they all ended up in the same prison. So that brings us to World War One. The most interesting spy that I found was Sarah Aronson, and she oversaw operations in Palestine of a spy ring and passed information to British agents offshore. She was American. She was an American Jewess, and she traveled extensively through the Ottoman territories, which is now Turkey, and you know, she was able to collect information, but so she was, the name of the network was NILI, N-I-L-I, and it was a Jewish espionage network which assisted the United Kingdom in its flight against the Ottoman Empire in Palestine between 1915 and 1917. There's actually a book you could get. It's called The Woman Who Fought an Empire, and it's about her.
Cool.
So these are women who really, what can I say? They were very, very influential in passing information. And, of course, the most famous spy of all, and I call her the most famous reindeer of all, was Mata Hari. Mata Hari is not a fictional character. She's a real person. She was a Dutch woman, very, very beautiful. She was an exotic dancer. And she passed information, she was caught, and she was executed. The women who spied in World War One, generally speaking, were executed. They were caught in prison, died in prison, or were executed. Another one was Edith Cavell, but Edith Cavell was not American. She was a British. What was happening at the end of World War One and into World War II was that the British and the Americans were beginning to collaborate quite a bit as far as spying was concerned. And Edith was a nurse. She was a nurse. And so she was able to gather information from the prisoners in her care. So, and there was one other. You know, what's interesting about all of these spies, both World War One and World War Two, is we're beginning to see a tremendous number of popular fiction books based on these women's lives. I mean, you're a librarian, so
yes.
I'll give you some of them. Kristen Hannah's The Nightingale, that's World War Two. The Alice Network, which was based on a woman by the name of Bettingay, and it's a true story. Well, it's not, you know, it's fictionalized, but she was really a very interesting spy and a very successful spy. But she was also imprisoned and died in prison. The Ventriloquists, which is about a bunch of journalists. Actually, it's a bunch of Belgians. When the Nazis took over Belgium, they decided that they would write a underground newspaper, and that's a very interesting story. The Lost Girls of Paris, which is, I mean, some of these are on the bestseller list. The Lilac Girls, these are all about these women who, you know, who were influential in carrying out various spy operations. I'd like to get to World War II because I think in World War II we had just so many women doing so many things.
Absolutely. Please get to World War II. Not to undermine everyone else.
I'm sorry, what?
I said not to undermine everyone else, but yeah, let's get to World War II.
Yeah, so we have, of course, Bletchley Park, which was the women who broke the Enigma the Enigma machine, which was the Nazi code machine that where they sent all of their information, their military information, and they broke that code in a place called Bletchley Park, and it was women who did it. We had stories about Kay Summers, who was Dwight David Eisenhower's driver. We have a television program series called Foyle's War, which was about a woman who drove a law enforcement officer around. And then we have Rosie the Riveter. These are all characters that most people, this is a familiar term to them. We have the Wasps. The Wasps, that's what my Annie Tillery's great-grandmother, that's what she was. She was a woman's air service pilot during World War II. We had the women of the OSS. There were 4,500 women who worked in the OSS during the war. The OSS was the precursor to the CIA. It was our first spy, I won't say that, first intelligence service, and it was started by a man by the name of Bill Donovan. It was commissioned by FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, and they were the special ops people during the war. And what I found in my research was that most of these women were pretty well connected. They were very well educated because they needed women who were multilingual. And and also what they did was they did research and analysis. What other information came in from the – you have to realize we didn't have internet then.
Right.
So information from other countries, we didn't have satellite communication, had to be through a spy network. Your photographs taken surreptitiously and somehow smuggled back into the country. So that all that had to be analyzed. They had to analyze maps from photographs that were taken by surveillance planes. And it wasn't like a U-2 spy plane. And this was like just – well, planes that were dropping bombs and taking pictures at the same time. They had what was called a morale operation, and some of us remember Tokyo Rose. Tokyo Rose was Japan's character who would get on the radio and she would tell lies to the American soldiers to demoralize them. Well, we had our counterpart of that as well. It was called the Voice of the People. They would also analyze biographical records, oral intelligence, when agents were captured, of course, they were questioned, and they had to analyze the information, make sure it was true. And, of course, the most, I guess, glamorous thing they did was handling agents in the field, where there would be parachute drops behind enemy lines, rescue of personnel, radio communications. You know, they would drop these women behind enemy lines in France, and then they would have to find a safe house. The spy organization, the resistance organization in France, is called the Maquis. There is actually a series on PBS now called The Resistance, all about that. So they did a lot, and there were 4,500 of them. Of course, we know about the defense industry in this country. 310,000 women were, it was 65% of the workforce, made the war materiel for, for our forces. But it's just amazing. One of the most famous women, there were a lot of famous women in the OSS. There was Julia Childs was in the OSS. She was in China and India. Also, Marlena Dietrich, she did was morale. In other words, she was like the USO. She went and she, but she also could pass information if it came her way. One of the most famous women was Virginia Hall. And there's a museum in New York City called Spyscape. And that's a fun spy museum to go to.
I keep hearing about it.
Yeah, well, what happens there is they take some of your personal information, and then you go through a series of computer games, sort of exercises, and they tell you what kind of a spy you would make. So it's pretty interesting. interesting. And but one of the most interesting ladies is Virginia Hall, who was an American. But she worked with British and American intelligence, and she did everything. She did the radio communication, and she also ran an escape route to get pilots who were downed behind enemy lines back back to England. So she was very important. She was called the Limping Lady because she had a very bad limp because she shot herself in the foot in a hunting accident.
Oh,
I know, I'm laughing because this is a woman who went through hell in the war. She was arrested. She was in prison. She risked her life over and over again, and she lived because she shot herself in the foot. Oh, dear.
Oh, man.
So basically, that's just the tip of the iceberg of what I do in my lecture, but
yeah,
that pretty much sums up what women did as spies, and as we were extremely important in the war. And then there was a lot of misogyny, because women were considered to be, you know, not as intelligent as men, not as brave, blah, blah, blah. So, and even after the war, it didn't seem that we ever got the recognition that we should have, but we are now. So,
yeah.
Better late than never.
It's really amazing that the stories are, you know, being told. And, I mean, I'm always learning about, you know, just new contributions women have made to, and you haven't heard of so many of them. I recently learned about what was her name, Noor Khan, who I believe she was she British or was she French? She was an Indian woman. And then I'm always hearing about Sophie Scholl, who ran the resistance within Nazi Germany, who was also a very interesting character. Not character, she's a person, and she was executed, as was Noor. But I think it's really important, and I love that, you know, your lecture covers all of this, because I think it's really important that we do learn about this.
Well, one of the things I bring out in my lecture is how, over time, once the OSS became the CIA, there were more and more women who had influential roles. And, of course, now the director of the CIA is Gina Haspel. So we went from women doing research in basements during World War II to the director of the CIA. So, and they will all admit that there was a certain amount of misogyny, but you know, you have to consider the culture at the time, and
right,
we are making progress.
And just to sort of marry the two, because I know we'd been talking about how there was no internet back then, and you know, the technology was still very very new. You had a woman like Hedy Lamarr, who was a beautiful actress. And she was involved in creating what we basically, like, you know, the internet and certain frequencies that we use to gather information now. So that's something that I've, Wi-Fi, and that's something that I've found very interesting, too. So, you know, I mean, while we didn't have that, there were women working behind the scenes to kind of give us what we have now. So we're all over it.
Yes, we are, and getting better all of the time.
Absolutely. Well, I would love to hear your full lecture, and I'm sure our listeners would love to hear your full lecture. And the Annie Tillery series, where is it available?
Well, it's available if you go to my website, lindamariafrank.com. You can click on any one of the books and go directly to Amazon or Barnes & Noble. And so selected libraries, some selected bookstores.
And you are on, I know you're on the lecture circuit in the libraries, so please look out at your local library for Linda Maria Frank. And thank you so much for talking to us about this. What a really exciting topic.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and it was fun to talk about it.
All right. So once again, this was Jessica, and my guest was... And I am going, excuse me, And we are going to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Thank you so much.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.